We are, in other words, every bit as confused as we were before we knew a thing about the air. Fog everywhere, indeed. Now, it's certainly possible that such mystification is actually one guise that enlightenment assumes. I think it is. But I want to float a far more modest proposal. That while the idea and experience of a literary atmosphere seems to be a metaphorical extension of the physical atmosphere, as known to and by modern science, these two kinds of air actually developed interdependently. They did that, I'm going to say, over the course of what we, rapaciously, I admit, call the long 18th century. In English print, the word atmosphere first appears in 1636, when the polymath John Wilkins's discovery of a new world in the moon less defines atmosphere than, obviously, projects it as an orb of gross, vaporous air immediately encompassing the moon. A few years later, Wilkins's fascinating treatise on cryptography, Mercury, or the Secret and Swift Messenger, spent pages picturing such immediately encompassing orbs as they might be mediated through the manifestly terrestrial body of letters. So Wilkins told his readers how to write by the sunbeams upon a wall in front of a home, and how to scribble on a glass and then oppose the glass against the full moon so that letters would appear through it. It would be hard to find a more literal instance of literary atmosphere, or at least of the evocative spaces between lexical lines. But Fuma Fugium, John Evelyn's 1661 treatise on the epidemical evil of coal-based air pollution in Restoration London, compounds analysis of the air's infinite mutations with the accidental effects of Evelyn's own well-wrought quasi-pastoral sentences upon a royal reader ostentatiously praised as the very breath in our nostrils. Most to the point, no doubt, the English pneumatic chemists themselves, from Robert Boyle, Edmund Bohun, and Stephen Hales, right up to Priestley, were all compulsive writers and self-conscious literary stylists. And they had to grapple with their subject, air's invisibility, its ubiquity, and the pressure exerted by its persistent, strong connotations within folkloric and faith traditions. These properties of the air give figurative language in general, but explicitly literary language in particular, an active and dynamic role in its conceptualization and investigation. Working within, and thereby shaping what we would call a then-new media environment composed of typographical elements, Britain's first aerial philosophers built into the print medium a unique reflexivity, a propensity to give rise, if only apparent, to its own effectual surroundings. This propensity was dramatized whenever it came to citing either the elements that compose what we call the air, or air's complication into what we call the atmosphere. Atmosphere presumably happening, that is, when air absorbs, and in absorbing makes apparent, the steams, effluvia, and all the abrasions of bodies on the surface of the earth. That last phrase came courtesy of John Arbuthnot, Augustan physician, satirist, and chronicler of the effects of air on human bodies in 1733. So we have air's elusiveness and its natural affinity with reflexive compositional forms, mainly print, that were, after all, built to make intangibles apparent and effectual. Over the course of the 18th century, these properties potentially licensed many different kinds of writing as principal investigators of the air. Indeed, the more widely diffused, the more superficial, and the more practiced in the mechanics of producing effects without supplying any immediate cause, the better. So it's just possible to imagine that popular fiction might even have an edge here. Where might we look for the first evidence of literary fiction's atmospheric dimension, whatever that byproduct of belles lettres it is that makes us feel as if we are in a superficial world that we know not to be real? You see, I have a definition of sorts. For evidence of the first literary atmosphere, many of us would hold up one or any of the popular Gothic novels of the 1790s. Admittedly, this would be to overlook such effects of earlier English fiction as the, quote, cheerful, sunshiny, breezy spirit that, according to Coleridge, prevails everywhere in Fielding's Tom Jones, and which the romantic poet closely contrasted with the close, hot, daydreamy continuity of Richardson's Clarissa. Coleridge is known to have tested these novelistic winds, or lack thereof, in 1813, some years after British atmospheric science had settled into such apparently stable forms as Luke Howard's 1803 modifications of the clouds, cirrus, cumulus, stratus, or Priestley's revolutionary isolation of 14 different kinds of pneumatic gases, from the carbons, monoxide, and dioxide, to nitrogen, and to some extent oxygen. More on that later. Even without cutting-edge natural philosophy to make air apparent, Coleridge may well have learned from the likes of Monk Lewis and Mother Radcliffe how to experience even the most Lockean fictions of the High Enlightenment as if they had a climate. At the very least, the Gothic novels of the 1790s definitely feel like the first in English to have been preoccupied with gross, vaporous air. These same novels, of course, visibly manufactured the impression of that air through the creakiest of devices, the squealing hinge, the moaning wind, the sputtering flame, you know, the technology as well as I do. The very same technology turns up all the time in scientific studies of the air from Boyle forward. We can glimpse their congress in this image, Joseph Wright of Derby's, still ubiquitous, it's on the Norton Anthology, 1764 image of an air pump experiment, where shadows encroach and faces convulse in horror, even as air's true nature is presumably made apparent through the most artificial devices. But by the last decades of the 18th century, studies that took the air as an object of knowledge, available only through artful instruments, that had given rise to a popular obsession with the possibility of knowing the atmosphere by immersing oneself, albeit still artificially, in it. Symptoms of this new preoccupation included the balloonomania of the 1780s, and there's an image of that resulting from the isolation of helium, not air, and the founding of the English Pneumatic Medical Institute in 1792. So every Englishman had a place where he could safely go to inhale nitrous oxide, which is what Coleridge, among others, did there. Here, too, we have Benjamin Franklin's endlessly copied kite and key experiments demonstrating that electricity is ambient and ambient's electric, which is one of many contemporary images. This is Benjamin West, I think, of Franklin out there in the atmosphere. Franklin, by the way, also experimented with gilt-bound books as conductors of electricity, which thereby revealed the charged and inherently communicative nature of the air about them and us. Gothic fiction sprang up everywhere in this newly charged atmosphere, and so it is not so surprising that they should be the first in English to which we easily apply the language of ambiance. So we still say, entirely without thinking, that Gothic writing gives us the chills and makes our hair stand on end the whole time. The electrical effect, you'll remember, that Radcliffe's Mysteries of Udolpho had on Jane Austen's susceptible Catherine Morland. In tingling the spine, chilling the blood, and raising the hair, Gothic literary atmosphere depends on the elastic and notably hackneyed spring of the literal into the figural, of the material into the immaterial, even of a way of bodily experiencing something into a conventional way of talking about it. So does a Gothic literary atmosphere share with our unstable ideas of the atmosphere a bothersome and yet communally binding ambiguity with respect to what is really and naturally there around us and what is not. The Gothic fictions of the later 18th century merit an even closer look because so many of them, from Matthew Lewis's The Monk to Charlotte Smith's The Orphan of the Castle, so reliably offer up two things. One is physical worlds visibly structured in and through writing, lost manuscripts, contracts, and court records that frame a given fiction from the start or seal it off in the end. Meanwhile, inside that fiction, we have graffitied wainscots and windows and walls, characters preternaturally equipped with pen and paper who virtually inhale and exhale the written word, books, like one in the Mysteries of Udolpho, that fall into, quote, damp corners that cause the covers to be disfigured and moldy, and that are in turn absorbed by readers in dank and drafty rooms, whose chemical composition is indistinguishable from that of the books that they contain, or that, were thus aware, contain them. Thin letters are surroundings, that's my point, in the hypergraphic Gothic romances of the later 18th century.